Good to see you again this morning. Appreciate everybody being out and enjoy the services so far. Certainly a privilege to be able to take the Lord's Supper and to commune with you brethren here in East Alton this weekend. I'd like to say first, I hope nobody leaves here depressed. The sermon's on depression, and sometimes when we get grief and loss and then we get depression going on in our lessons, sometimes the message may feel a little gloomy. But I want to suggest to you this morning, okay, this is a new PowerPoint. one of our brethren did this for us last night so we could have something. I looked at that and it's like, is that mine? But it has the material. What I want to talk with you about this morning is that all of us go through periods of time when we have depression. That's a normal part of human life. We see sometimes that depression goes along with temperament. Each of us has a different temperament. You ever have a baby that was just a bubble of energy, and then another one that was a little bit lethargic? Nothing was particularly wrong with them. They were just turned different. So some people are more higher energy, and some are lower energy, and that doesn't mean that anything's wrong with them. It simply means that they're different. Temperament has a part to play in depression, and wherever baseline is for the individual, when they get excited, they go up, and when they get when they're not so excited or they tend to be more inner turned, then they go down. Now, if you start out with a lower baseline, you're going to be a little lower. If you start out with a higher baseline, you'll be a little higher in that cycle. I want to say something in the very beginning. I don't intend to keep everybody here for a long time this morning. We'll try to get out at least by noon, hopefully before. So we can have something to eat. But I want to suggest that many of our brethren and many of our educators, those in the mental health fields, have not done a very good job of being educated on what depression is. And what I want to suggest is that depression in itself is not a diagnosis. It's a category. And there are 9 types of depression. And these display at different times in different people. I don't intend for this to be a medical lecture or presentation, but I do want to say this so we understand what we're talking about. We're defining the terms here. And I want to just kind of identify for you the different types of depression. When most folks talk about depression, they're talking about major depressive episodes. And what they mean is that, and this is about 7% of the population, this is not a large number of people, 7% of the population has an episode of major depression at some time. Of those, 90% respond well to treatments for major depression. The symptoms of major depression are extreme sadness, hopelessness, lack of energy, irritability, trouble concentrating, guilty feelings, physical pain, sometimes thoughts of death or pending doom or even suicide. And the best practice for that is medication, something that elevates the mood. Because this type of depression, while it may be due to some circumstance in life, this more often than not is some chemical issue, and it's best treated with a chemical to bring it up to where the body's got enough of the right chemical to take the depressed mood off. Another form of depression is what's called dysthymia or dysthymic depression. And dysthymia is a person who is very functional but has a generalized sadness about them. It's kind of a slow move or a low mood for a period of time. It's frequently characterized by just a generalized sadness, trouble concentrating, fatigue, and sleep and appetite problems. And the best treatment for that is not medication. The best treatment for that is talk therapy, where something inside is troubling the individual and they need to talk about it. So that's dysthymic depression. Another type is postpartum depression. And obviously that would be for female. 85% of new moms feel sadness after giving birth. The chemicals are trying to get back into range. But about 13% of that 83% have feelings of extreme sadness, fatigue, loneliness, hopelessness, sometimes suicidal thoughts, and sometimes fear that they will hurt their baby. Some of the things on the news where you've seen that people have a child and will discard the child or will kill the child, this more than likely is part of what's going on there, but I don't hear that a lot when we have the trials and all that. But postpartum depression. And so kind of watch for that. The treatment for that is kind of talking through it, the adjustments to motherhood or to additional motherhood, and also chemical treatments with that. So it's talk and chemicals are the treatments of choice. There's another type of depression that is called seasonal affective disorder. And what that is it happens with about 4 to 6% of the U.S. population. If you'll notice, that's almost as much as has major depression. But seasonal affective disorder is simply when you don't get enough sunlight and the vitamin D's get real low, and that depresses the mood and so forth. And so usually we'll see this from winter to spring, the periods of time when you don't have as much sunlight in the day. When we go up north to where they have long nights and long days, what we see is during those long nights an awful lot of seasonal affective disorder that often is misdiagnosed as major depression, but it isn't. It's caused by a lack of sunshine. And obviously, the treatment for that is not a chemical, but the treatment for that is what we call phototherapy, which is simply sitting in front of a special lamp where your body is able to get the rays that it normally would get from the sun. That's that type of a disorder. Very lethargic kinds of action during that time, tiredness and sadness and so forth. Then there's another type called atypical depression, and it's a very unusual depression, and it is usually undiagnosed. And this is symbolized by not so much the cognitive issues as it is by a heaviness in the arms and the legs. Your arms just feel heavy. Your legs feel heavy, like you can't move them. It's almost like a form of paralysis. And the results of this are oversleeping, overeating with weight gain, irritability, and usually relationship problems as the individual lashes out at those around them in the frustration. Best treatment for that, best practice, is talk therapy, not medications. Then there is psychotic depression. This is characterized by delusions and sometimes by hallucinations and by certainly false beliefs. And 10 to 15% of depressed people show signs of some kind of a catatonic episode. That is, they just stare and often have trouble breaking the stare. They often spend a lot of time in bed. They sit and they stare, and they don't respond appropriately to pleasure or pain. The best treatment for that is medication that brings the chemicals back in line. Bipolar depression is another type. I'm spending a little moment on this because I want to be sure we're talking about the same thing for the rest of the lesson. But bipolar depression is characterized by extreme low cycles, that is, very low lows, followed by very high highs. And during the high moments, the thoughts are racing. It's a time of impulsivity. It's a time when things aren't thought out very well. That's where you have people kick into their manic moments. And if it goes too high, it'll go into psychotic moments. During those times, what will happen, if you've ever seen it, it's kind of scary. But during that time, what will happen is the person will focus on something that's a key piece of how they think. For instance, we had an individual that came in to the psych hospital where I was a clinical director, and the medical director called me up and said, "Can you come up and sit with him?" And I did, and said, "You're going to watch him close, but don't get too close because he could be violent." And so what I did is I went in and I worked with him, and in that quick snap of a finger, this guy was across the desk and had my phone taken apart just almost that quick. It was rapid motion. Never saw anything like it. And And it turned out that this gentleman was very mechanical. He put things together for a living. He could also disassemble them very quickly. He was in manic, rapid motion, and he was psychotic. He wasn't on the same planet I was on. But impulse control, he was across that desk, and the phone was apart in just very short order. This gentleman later, when we had the police to take him to the state hospital, he kicked out the windows of the police car and destroyed the police car, and the city wanted to send us a bill for it, but we didn't want to pay it. That was that kind of psychotic high. But other times, it doesn't usually go to psychosis, but it's real high highs. You'll find people compulsive shopping, just compulsions all over the place. A lot of times people will be acting out sexually, just compulsive, repetitive affairs and activities during that time, just rapid motion kind of stuff. And by the way, if you are in your reality mind, you are responsible even though you're acting by impulse. So depression is not an excuse to sin. But I want to suggest to you that the lows on this are characterized by just extreme lows, basically incapacitating lows, where a person may not want to get out of bed. They may just have lethargy for a period of time. They're just kind of things that bring them normal pleasure aren't and don't. And 2-3% of the population have bipolar disorder. I believe it is one of the diagnoses that is way overdiagnosed, along with major depression. I believe that that's just real easy when someone comes in and says, "I can't eat, I can't sleep, I'm tired all the time," and someone sees you for 5 minutes and says, "Well, you're depressed," and so then they give you a pill and send you home, tell you to come back, and let's get this medication adjusted. A good diagnosis requires a good workup before you get the diagnosis. And what I would suggest is a lot of times people go in to folks that are not within their scope of practice, but yet are licensed by the state to give those diagnoses. And if that sounds like a slam on the profession, it is. But what I want to suggest is you need a good psychiatric workup, and that's going to take you a good hour, maybe 2 hours, to figure out what's really going on with you. This is not a 5 to 10 minute slap a diagnosis on, drop a bill with managed care, and send you to the pharmacy. That's not appropriate treatment. That's not quality treatment from where I sit. That's my judgment on that, and not everybody agrees with me, but it's still my judgment. Major or bipolar depression responds to talk therapy and also to medications, and bipolar truly is one of the disorders that is chemically based. But we can talk to people about signs and symptoms when you know that's coming on, how to deal with it, and some behavior modification kinds of things with that. There's another one that is called premenstrual dysphoric disorder. It's very seldom diagnosed, but yet it strikes once. It basically strikes in women's lives, and it's once a month, usually in the second half of their menstrual cycle. It is characterized by overwhelming depression, by high anxiety. This is not PMS. That happens before. This is after. Exaggerated mood swings, acts of rage. PMS affects about 75% of females in some kind of symptom, from mild to moderate or extreme. But 5% of the women have a more extreme response during the second part of the cycle. And that is truly what is called a dysphoric disorder, and that is characterized with the depressions. It is seldom diagnosed, but it is often misdiagnosed, but it is best treated by the talk therapies and by proper nutrition. You heard me right. Because we've got some problems with vitamins and the minerals in the system and so forth, and things not being quite in balance there. So as you see so far, you don't treat them all alike. Just because someone says this is depression, it's a category. What kind of depression is important? There's also what's called situational depression. And situational depression is triggered by a stressful event or a life-changing event, such as the loss of a job, the death of a loved one, trauma of some sort, a breakup. And this is 3 times more common than major depression. Now, situational depression is often misdiagnosed when a person gives the symptoms but doesn't give the story. In order to properly diagnose, those that are giving you the diagnosis need to know the whole story, not just the pieces of it. If you go in and tell someone, I can't sleep, I'm depressed, I don't even want to go to work anymore, and blah, 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 they're going to slap major depression on you when it may not be that. It may be one of these others. And you may be treating the wrong thing and wonder why it's not getting any better. It's because it's misdiagnosed, and you're treating the wrong thing. So I say all of that just kind of because a lot of our folks are uneducated on that. And if you want to read more about the different types of depression, you can Google or Bing that, or on your computer, or you can go to a book called the DSM, which is a Diagnostic Standard Manual. The 4TR is the one that was just replaced with DSM-5. Most of your clinicians are still using the DSM-4, but there you'll find all this breakout. You'll find page after page of the signs and symptoms, and that's what the person's looking for in the assessment where they make the diagnosis. And let me say this, don't go read that and then go repeat it back to your doctor so you can get meds. Some people do that too. We call that doc shopping, and that's drug-seeking behavior, so don't do that. But those are some things about depression. And so when I'm talking about depression, I'm not talking about a diagnosis. I'm talking about a range of diagnoses in this lesson. The good news is that we're not the only ones on earth that have had a problem with that have problems with depression. Depression has happened throughout the Bible. We have cases where in times of uncertainty that depression came on. Joseph, for instance, when he's thrown into a pit by his brothers, and then he's sold into slavery, and then he's bought, and then he becomes a slave in the household of Potiphar. During times like that, those can be life-changing times. Those can be depressing times. And then later he's thrown into prison. Those can be depressing times when life really makes sudden changes for people, and they may or may not rebound to that. Joseph was one that rebounded well. But it still takes you to times of depression and soul-searching and uncertainty. King David was one that there throughout the Psalms. If you read some of the Psalms, some of these Psalms, this fellow was in the pits. He's out here. His enemies are closing in on him. Life just looks awful. He's wishing that death would swallow him up. And you read some of those Psalms, and they're very depressing. That would indicate to us a depressed mood with King David. The Apostle Paul had times that were depressing for him when he would hear of depressing news or discouraging news. That happened with him as well. And then some others here that we could talk about, but I'm not going to go a lot into that this morning. I want to suggest that there is healing for depression. And in talking about this, those who suffer from depression, as we've already said, is the majority of Americans at some point in their life suffer from some sort, one of those nine depressions. That's just a standard thing in our culture that happens. Most folks get over it in a couple, 3 weeks, and so they ride out the episodes. Some go to the doctor and get a label, and sometimes they keep that label for a lifetime. And I suggest that it needs to be reassessed over time, because a diagnosis of depression in any form is not necessarily a lifetime diagnosis. Most of the time, it is not, because the depressions tend to go in episodes as the moods kind of naturally rise and fall. For some people, major depression is lifetime. And that tends to travel in families. Sometimes there's very much a genetic base, but also it's kind of the idea of, is this a learned behavior or is this a physical disorder? And when we start looking at families with depression, sometimes what we see is a genetic base, and we also see a learned helplessness that goes in those families. That here's a kid's been raised around depressed people. Since we socialize by imitating the people around us, if you're raised around depressed people, who are you going to imitate? You're going to imitate depression, when in fact you may not really have depression. You may be imitating the people that are around you who are depressed. So that's where you need some differentiation about that. And one of the ways that you'll see that is as the depressed person gets in, as the person that thinks they're depressed but maybe has just learned it, as they get into a different setting, then what you see is they start coming into life and the lights come on. It's like that person's not depressed. That person's learned how to live in a depressed environment. There's a difference in that, as you can see. So what do we do with someone that's been raised around in a depressed environment? What we do is we encourage them to use opportunities to kind of make a break where they can develop in a setting that is not a depressed setting. That's what we would do with something like that. So many people suffer from depression. As we indicated, the commonality of all these are loss of sleep, loss of interest in normal things, difficulty concentrating, agitation and restlessness, and sometimes there's memory loss. Depression usually is like putting blinders on an individual, most of these forms. And what it will do is it will give a person tunnel vision. And what that means is that they tend to be focused on that which is the hopeless and the helpless, and as they look down the tunnel, they don't see a lot of light or any light at the end of that tunnel. So life is seen through the eyes of the blinders of kind of the doom and gloom, and it'll never get any better. That's what happens when those chemicals start working like that, or when some situation happens and things just kind of close in and we get tunnel vision. That's depression. Or at least some form of depression. Now I want to go to a passage in 1 Kings, the 19th chapter, and the first 18 verses. And I want to study with you about a man who is truly clinically depressed. And I also want to note that this man is a man of God. And what it says is that children of God can have depression. This man, in this case, we're going to read about and see if we can figure out what happened to him, how it happened, and how he overcame this. And that's what we're going to look at here with this man. And you know this man. His name is Elijah. And I'm in 1 Kings chapter 18 first, because in 1 Kings 18, what we find is Elijah in triumph on Mount Carmel. He is put to flight. Actually caused the deaths of, or resulted in the death of, the prophets of the Asherah and the Baalim. He has the ultimate testimony of God from heaven as God sends fire down and lights the altar that is the wood has been soaked in water. God lights that and basically shows that there's a God in Israel. This is the God, and this is the one that we need to serve. And where would you expect him to be in the next chapter? The people of Israel have rallied. Everyone's coming and standing up, and now God's in triumph there, and Elijah's the leader. And the next thing you'd expect to see is that they move further on to victory, right? That's not what you see. In chapter 19, we see Elijah that goes out, and we find him sitting under a juniper tree, way out of far from other people. And in this chapter, I want just to read through this with you. In verse 3, chapter 19, and what I want to notice is after an exhausting moment, as Elijah had, the follow-up to that is the rebound. And it went into depression. The rebound went too low. Elijah has slain all the prophets. Elijah and his company have slain all the prophets with the sword. And Jezebel sends a message to Elijah and says, "So let the gods do to thee and more so, if I make not thy life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time." In other words, you're on 24-hour notice. We're going to hunt you down and kill you. Now, that would scare most people. But you know, this isn't a new threat. This threat's been going on for 3 years. But this time it bothered him. And it bothered him so much that he went into a depression. And look at his response. And when he saw that, he arose and went for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. What happened here? Elijah, whereas he had led the charge before, now we see this man in retreat. that here we have an unreasonable fear. This woman has not, this is not a new charge, as I said. He's had this death threat on him for a long time, and God has led him through this, but whatever the situation here is, this one hits him differently. And sometimes that will happen to us in life, is we are exhausted, we're worn out, we've overdone it. That's what Elijah had done. We've overdone it. We're tired. We don't have the energy to keep going on. We need to take a chill. And then something else follows right on the heels of that. Sometimes people say things come in threes, and this is the kind of thing that we're talking about. And just one thing after another just keeps hitting you. And after a while, you get discouraged. Maybe not after a while, after two or three of those things. So Elijah picks up, and he heads out to the wilderness, and there he's going to try to outrun this queen. There's a death wish on him, and notice that Elijah is very tired, so tired that he lays down and sleeps under a juniper tree, and an angel of the Lord touches him and says, "Arise and eat." Now here's what I want us to see. Let me back up. Elijah under this tree, and he requested for himself that he might die. And he said, "It's enough, Jehovah, take away my life, for I'm not better than my father's." All right, what's happened? This depressive episode has created irrational fears. He has a death wish. In other words, I'd be better off dead. And here it talks about, take my life from me. I don't even want to live anymore. Take my life from me. And that would be traits that would be associated with suicide, although Elijah wasn't suicidal. He's excessively tired in verse 5, and so he sits down under a tree, so tired that God provides his nourishment through an angel. You see that? This man, so he's not eating right, he's afraid, he has gone out, he's fearing of life itself, and also we see that he has feelings of rejection. In verse 10, and also some self-pity. I want you to notice when God says, "What are you doing here?" He said, "I have been very jealous for Jehovah, the God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thy altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And he says the same thing in verse 14. Now, what's going on with Elijah? I would call that being on the pity pot. I'm the only one that wants to do right. Poor me. And so he sits here and says that I'm the only one that's trying to serve God. And now they're trying to kill me. And I only, you see that? I only am left. There's nobody else trying to do right but me. See that tunnel vision there? And that's what's going on with Elijah. All right, now this is a man of God, and what that tells me, as I said before, is that children of God sometimes can get into a frame of mind like this. We're going to talk about how to get out of it. But God does some very specific things for Elijah, and I want to look at that. So how does God go about this healing process? I want to suggest first that, and if you'll read along with me in this, the very first thing that God does is God tells him, "You need to get up and go where you can worship me." Do you ever notice a common theme to our lessons this morning? Is that you need to get up and you need to go and you need to worship me. So God gives us this case study and God tells us what this man needs to do. And I've got my notes all mixed up here. Excuse me just a half a second. I don't need my notes. All right, so he sends it. He tells Elijah, "You need to get up and you need to go over. You need to go to a worship place." Let me pick up my text here. I lost my spot. God tells him that he needs to go and to start with verse 15. And Jehovah said to him, "Go, return on thy way to the wilderness of Damascus." In other words, the way out is the way you got in this mess. "And when thou comest, thou shalt anoint Hazael to be king of Syria, and Jehu the son of Nimshi shalt thou anoint to be king over Israel, and Elisha the son of Shaphath, and another gentleman shalt thou anoint to be prophet in thy room." What has God told him to do? What God has told him first is, you need to go to a place where you worship me. Second is, God tells Elijah that you have a problem. And the problem that Elijah has is with his thinking. Thinking can get us into depression. You follow along in the text. But thinking can get us into depression. And what Elijah is thinking is, I'm the only one trying to do right. You know what God tells him? You're a poor bookkeeper. There are 7,000 who have not bowed their knee to Baal. Don't you tell me you're the only one. You don't know. And sometimes that's how people get into depression or stay in depression, some of these clinical depressions, is they try to mind God's business. And they're out here on the pity pot saying, I'm the only ones trying to do anything right. And what God says is, you're a poor bookkeeper. So what God does is help him get his thinking straight. When we get things in perspective and realize that God's in charge and we're not, and it's not all about us, see that? All about him. I'm the only one. When we get that thing straight, then what happens is the depression starts lifting. Because now we are not putting ourselves in charge, God is in charge. So God deals with Elijah's false beliefs that he's the only one trying to do anything right. And then look what God does. God doesn't say, listen, I just need you to sit here for 2,000 or more years, 3,000 years, and long about the 20th century, there's a little purple pill that's going to be brought about, and if you'll just sit here and wait, when that little purple pill comes out, it'll just take all your problems away. God didn't tell him that. See, there was a cure for depression in the days of Elijah before little purple pills. And what God's saying is first is, you need to do a little rest. And God did have him rest. And the angels came and served him some food. He needed his proper nourishment. He needed to get back. That takes a little time, so God took some patience with him. But you need to eat right, then you need to get up, and you need to get your worship right. And then what you need to do is you need to get your thinking right and realize that you're not in charge, I am. And don't you tell me that you're the only one that's trying to do the right thing. That's just feeling sorry for yourself. And so God tells him to quit that, but God gets his thinking right when God settles the score and says there's 7,000 more. And then what he does is God gives Elijah something to do. You know what will pull you out of depression quicker than anything else? And that is getting something to do. Get up and get busy. And what I tell people is you may have to fake it till you make it, but if you need to fake it till you make it, get up and do something. And what I suggest to you is sometimes that is in spending time with some of the things that used to bring us pleasure. Maybe some craft or hobby that used to bring some pleasure. Or it may be spending some time with an individual. Sometimes grandchildren can help us with that, especially if they're real active grandchildren. They can help us with that. And in other words, we're talking about some diversion. Here's what God did for diversion with Elijah. He said, I need you to get up, and I need you to go out here to and start a school. Do you see how God shifted a man who was on burnout? Burnout is the operative term here. This man was on burnout, and God chose for him a different course in his life. And it would be a greater course than the one he had already followed. So here's part two of your life. You've already kind of burned out on that. So here's what I need you to do. I need you to get up, go anoint some kings, and I also need you to start a school for the prophets. And there's going to be a young man come after you that needs to be your apprentice and needs to learn from you how to be a prophet. And there's some other people out there who need to learn the same thing. So I need you to go out here and teach them how to do that. And here's my point here, is that what God is telling Elijah to do is to go out and start a legacy. That the things that you're not a young man. And so the things you have learned, you haven't learned for those things to die with you. And I want to suggest that's true of each one of us, is that we have all learned lessons through life, and those lessons need to be passed on to other people. Beethoven wrote a song, How Shall the Young Secure Their Hearts and Keep Their Lives from Sin? And the song has several nice thoughts in it, but here's what I would ask. How do young people, how does the next generation learn how to do what we know how to do? And that's where we become trusted mentors, we become coaches, we become life guides to people that are before us. Sometimes we were moving too fast when our own kids came along to pass those on. But as grandparents, or if there's grandparents in the life of young couples, grandparents, the kids, those are the people that can teach us great lessons in life. I get very distressed in our culture with a disregard that's being shown by toward folks as they get older. And we have the expressions, oh, they're just old school. I hate that term, because that almost says that old school is the old way and it's not worth knowing. We have new and better ways now. And I want to suggest that's part of what's wrong with the world today, is that we tried new and better things that weren't new and better. They were just new and we thought they were better. But the young generation needs to learn. The Bible talks about aged women are to teach the younger women, older women to teach the younger women. I hadn't found a woman yet, says she's the older woman. Have you? But I won't tell you what. Here's what that means. I think that's comparative. And if you'll look, if someone's older than you, then you're the older woman. And you have something to teach them. And here's what I'm saying, is that in life, we take our journey. We go down the road of life, and we learn a lot of things. A lot of the things I've shared with you this weekend are things I've learned along through life. Life lessons as well as learned lessons. And each one of us has a story to tell. Each one of us has gone a journey. Each one of us has wisdom, hopefully, that we can pass on to the next generation and that we can share with each other who are struggling with moments of what do I do? And so in some kind of crisis. We need to share our legacy. And Elijah needed to do that. He needed to pass on to Elisha what he knew. Now, I want to tell you what. Elisha was more intelligent or knew more at the end than Elijah did. And I'll tell you why. Because Elisha learned everything Elijah knew, plus he already knew what he knew. So he knew more than Elijah. And that's the idea of passing wisdom down to other generations. Our young people today and our culture today has an awful lot of challenges, but throwing out people because they're old school is the wrong approach. The Bible says that the hoary head or the white hair is to be respected, and there needs to be respect for our elders, respect for those that have traveled through life and who have life's lessons. People who may not be as fast on their feet, but who can sit and basically spend that time. In my own life, I've had a great-grandmother, a grandmother, and several others along the way that while they had suffered some things that affected them physically, they were able to sit under the shade tree, or we were able to go for a walk out picking up peaches and pears and different stuff. And I learned a lot about life before I was 14 years old. And I tell you who I learned it from, not those that were busy trying to put bread on the table, but I learned it from the older people who were sitting there and shared their life's experience and the family stories and built the routines and rituals in my family that began to form my life. And you have those people too. Spend time with them. The wisdom that we have accumulated in life on our journey needs to be shared. And I learned that from this lesson here. And when we share that and we feel like life is over, I'm just being parked here, I've got nothing else to give, you go sit in the shade tree and talk to your grandkid or to some young people. Life ain't over. I know better than say ain't. But it's not over. And just because there's been changes and situations in our life that are a little different, we, like Paul, talks about how I know how to be wealthy and I know how to be poor. I know how to be in prison. I know how to do this. I know how to survive. And a lot of our people that are coming behind us don't know how to do that. Where are they going to learn that? Either through the school of hard knocks or by walking in our shoes as we lead them. That's what Elijah needed to do. And you know what was going to happen? That was going to help him. By him helping others, you know what he was doing? He was helping himself to come out of his depression. I don't know if Elijah knew that, but it sure did work. And so the rest of the story you can read about there in the text. And so Elijah had something to do. God had something for him to do. And God brought healing to his life. So what did God do? God sent him to connect with the church of his day, which is an Old Testament group. God focused him on what the problem was. The problem is your thinking's wrong. God dealt with those cognitive distortions and gave him, refueled him. And what that did is that reset his chemistry in his body as he rested, as he healed, and now as he shifts his thinking, and then he had a plan of what do I do now? He could not go backwards in life. He could not relive history. You know, what he had done, he had already done. Sometimes we get to a point we think, well, you know, I've done everything I can do. That's when you ask God for something different. I'm going to use myself for an example for a moment, then we're going to wrap this up. Back in 1997, I was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, and I thought my life was over. I came to realize that some things were over in my life. But what I also came to realize is that as I went through the chemotherapy and the things that the doctors were doing to me to try to take care of all this problem, what I came to realize is wherever I am here for a reason. I'm here for such a moment as this. And what I did when I sat in the room with people getting the drips, the IV drips of the chemo that would dull our brains, even as we plugged in and we started our sessions, there was 5 of us, and of those 5, I thought, I've got a captive audience. They ain't going nowhere, and neither am I. And so I started talking with them about God. And I use that opportunity not to feel sorry for myself as I go drip, drip, drip and get fuzzier and fuzzier. But I chose that moment to use that for the glory of God. And I want to share with you, when you have times when your life takes a sudden turn, then you use that moment for the glory of God. God will bring people into your life at those moments that you would not meet under any other circumstance. And God is affording you an opportunity if you don't sit there and feel sorry for yourself. And so use the moment. Whether we're in our depression, or whether we're in some elated state, or whether it's just a normal day, whether our body is questionable, whether it will go on, or whatever's happening, do it to the glory of God. Give God the glory, give God the praise, and He'll raise you up. Those were tough days. God spared me. I've had no recurrence of that, though I have memories. And as I think of that, I remember those times I asked, God, what's next? If you spare me, what else? And I didn't get answers to that for a long time. But one of the answers to that is what I'm doing today. See, God's not done with us yet. There are people all around us that we can influence. So let us not spend time taking God's business and figuring out how many people are trying to do right. Let us not spend time out here running from the enemy when God tells us, above all, we need to stand. If we run, the enemy will pursue. If we stand, the enemy is a coward, and he will flee from us. Yes, in our depressed moments, many of those things are really things that need to be treated. But that doesn't mean I'm done. I'm not my diagnosis. You're not your diagnosis. There's things you can do. There's ways you can serve. There's talents you have. There's people you meet in dark moments. And those people you can influence if you look and use it as an opportunity rather than a weight. An amazing thing will happen. As we begin to focus on how to help others, we often learn that we have helped ourselves even greater. Do you remember a passage in Acts 1 that isn't quoted in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but it says, even as our Lord said, it is better to give than to receive. That isn't just about money. That is about sharing ourselves and our lives and making a difference in the lives of other people, regardless of what standpoint we're coming from, making a difference in the lives of others. It's more blessed to give than receive. Your blessing is not going to be as much in receiving the blessing as it is in sharing the blessing. That's scriptural. That's scriptural. And so let us be about our Father's business, but let our Father's business not only be just about me. Let it be about others as we share the precious message. In 1929, there was a young man who in the years before 1929 had made quite a name for himself. He got out and purchased a number of department stores, and he had overfinanced himself at the bank, figuring that the boom would last even on further until he paid off his bills. Little did he know that 1929 would bring a stock market crash, and the banks that held his notes would call in his debts. And this man, who was riding high when everything was going good, went into the pits of despair. Despair even of life itself. And up in Kellogg, Michigan, he went to the Mayo Clinic of their day. It wasn't Mayo, it was a different one. And he went there and he was so depressed and despondent that one night he sat and wrote goodbye letters to his family. He was so depressed, he was not responding to treatment of any kind. And he really didn't expect to wake up to see the next morning. But the sun came up. And this young man walked down the hall. He was in his late 20s. Walked down the hall, kind of trying to figure out, is this heaven? But he hadn't died. And as he walked down the hall, he passed a chapel in that psych hospital. And from the chapel, they were singing a song. Be not dismayed, whate'er betide, God will take care of you. Beneath His wings of love abide, God will take care of you. That man got better. Within a week, he was released. You know his name. J.C. Penney. You know, when we can't count anymore in our bank accounts or our budgets or the money in our pocket, and it seems like our world gets smaller and smaller until we even wonder if there's going to be food, we need to remember the God of heaven supplies our needs. We read last night, be not anxious. God will give us our food, our clothing, our raiment. That didn't say my car and my other stuff. But God will take care of me. Who was it that said, when I am weak, I am strong? It was one of the writers of the Bible. And in those times, what we need to do is not look down and not dwell in the gloom, but to look up to the one that can help us, even if you would, to walk above the crowd, to walk on the water. Jesus can help us in that. Sometimes bad political things happen. And I remember a passage in the Old, actually a book in the Old Testament. I'm going to give you the short version of that book. It's the book of Habakkuk. We don't read that a lot, but it's a poem, actually. And Habakkuk was one of God's prophets. And Habakkuk was upset with God. He may have been a little depressed about it. At least he was frustrated. And what he asks, he cries out in the first chapter, and he says, God, what are you doing? Don't you see that we're oppressed on every hand? What are you doing? And God says, or why don't you do something, is what he's asking. And God answers Habakkuk and says, well, I am doing something. And Habakkuk says, well, tell me what you're doing. This is my version of that. Tell me what you're doing. And God says, well, I'm raising up a wicked king to come over and kick you guys and take you away and make slaves out of you. And Habakkuk says, I wish you hadn't told me that. Now what am I supposed to do? And Habakkuk realizes in the last chapter it ends that what am I going to do now? That I will rise above the crowd like a deer on the top of the mountains. And while the battle rages below, I will have a bond with him who is in charge. That's the book of Habakkuk. Read it sometimes. And what we realize sometimes is that we don't want to know the future. Suppose you knew everything about what's going to happen from now until you end up in heaven. You know, maybe that would create anxiety for sure. It's like, oh no, I got to go through this today. The valley of the shadow of death today and whatever tomorrow. But you know what? God holds back some things from us that we don't need to know. But what we do need to know is who's in charge. And that is the God of heaven. Where he leads, we need to follow. And be not dismayed, whate'er betide. God will take care of you. Do you believe that? And may God help us to ever walk in that. And to keep that as our mantra, if you would. God will take care of me. He's seen me through other things. He'll see me through this. You know somebody that said that. His name was David. He helped me kill a bear and a lion. And I guess if I can tackle them, I can tackle this giant. Giants come in different forms. And sometimes they come in the form of depression. But you can conquer that giant. You can still be effective for God. And along the way, you'll find others that are just like you and that want to know, well, what did you do? How'd you get past that? Sometimes we draw on their strength, and sometimes others in the same situation draw on our strength. That's our lesson today. Maybe someone is here this morning that needs to respond to the gospel. God does love and care for you. And sometimes it takes a process to bring us to where we want to be. But let's be patient with God, because as the little sticker says, he ain't done with you yet. And let's be patient with God, and let's pray that that God is patient with us, because sometimes we must be very trying to him. And let's just have God be patient with us. Are you here this morning and need some special prayers? Do you need some help from your brethren? In both of our lessons today, we've talked about how communities can come together, how people can come together and provide support and encouragement. Especially those who have walked the journey ahead can share with those that are walking behind. But let us use this opportunity. And as a church family of God, we have that opportunity. But you know, before we're going to be able to help folks, we need to know what your need is. People suffer in silence sometimes because they don't ever talk about what their need is. They're ashamed, they're embarrassed, that they can't handle it. If I understand right, that's why we need God, because we can't handle it. And that's why we need God's people. And we need to pray with us and to know what we're going through and to know our struggles and to encourage us in those. And this is one of those times that you can come and make those wishes known. Maybe you have some sin to confess, or maybe you just need to ask for prayers about what's going on with you. And I want to suggest that should that happen, it doesn't end here this morning. This is not an event. This is a process. And when someone's asking for prayers, we don't forget them tomorrow morning or the next day or the next day. We remember them in our prayers, and we remember them by staying in touch with them and encouraging them. That's the way God intends for it to be. That's called fellowship. And so if you're here this morning and need to respond some way to the gospel, God will take care of you, but he needs you to reach out and do your part as well. Would you do that while we stand and sing?